Before the Holocaust, before genocide had a name, violence swept across post-World War I Russia, and the church was forced to choose between courage, silence, and survival. I'm Laura Lee Siemens, and this is Church History. Imagine a world where the war is over, but the killing is just beginning. Where neighbors turn on neighbors, where churches lose their power, and where faith is tested not in sermons, but in silence and blood-stained streets. In the years after World War I, before the word genocide even existed, Jewish communities across Eastern Europe were being erased, and the church stood at a crossroads between courage and complacency. Today, we're going to step into the uneasy aftermath, into a time when history was warning us of what was still to come. Welcome to the new year. We're continuing our series on the church at war. Last year, we walked through the stories of Christians on all sides of World War I. Now, we're going to step into the uneasy silence that followed. The years when the guns stopped, but the violence did not. What happened in between World War I and World War II? Today's episode takes us into post-war Russia, into a genocide that had no name yet, and into the haunting question of how the church acted while it unfolded. Picture a small village at dawn. Frost is clinging to the thatched roofs. Smoke curls from chimneys where bread was meant to bake that morning. Then, boots hit the frozen road. Doors are kicked open. Jewish families are dragged from their homes. Children still half asleep, mothers clutching shawls, fathers pleading that go unanswered. It hardly matters which uniform the men wear. Red army units come, green peasant bands follow. Others arrive under other banners. Each claims a different reason, but the outcome is the same. One historian wrote, "Jews were accused in turn of being Bolsheviks, capitalists, and nationalists. They were scapegoats for every side, and they were blamed for every fear." Historians today estimate that more than 100,000 Jews were killed during this time. Others would say that number is low, and it could be actually between 200 and 300,000. Hundreds of thousands more were wounded, raped, or driven from their homes. 600,000 Jewish people fled as refugees, crossing borders with nothing but what they could carry. Entire Jewish quarters vanished, and two-thirds of Jewish homes in affected regions were looted and burned. In some places, the violence reached a level described as exponential, even for such a brutal era. Synagogues and study houses where families hid and prayed were set on fire, with hundreds still trapped inside. Nearby, non-Jewish neighborhoods guarded their own homes from the flames, but did not intervene as the Jewish communities burned. Surviving testimonies tell a hard truth. Much of the killing was carried out not by armed bands, but by peasants, some even Christians. They acted alongside after the fighters had moved on. In the regions that remained, there were a few Christian rescuers, but they were mostly absents. Imagine the year is 1918. You are a Christian living in a small village in Russia. Your hands know this soil. You've planted it, harvested, and buried loved ones in it, especially after the end of World War I. You've lived and worked alongside Jewish families your entire life. You shared wells and market days. You nodded greetings on the road. You heard their prayers drift from the synagogue, just as your own hymns have risen from your church. But one day, everything changed. The war is over, but peace never comes. Armed men arrive without warning. Their uniforms mismatched, their anger sharp. They tell you the Jews are to blame for the hunger, for the shortage, for the chaos tearing the family apart. One group calls them the Bolsheviks. Another says they're capitalists. Each accusation sounds convincing when fear has already taken hold. And you watch as doors are broken down and families you've known for decades are dragged into the street. You recognize the faces. You hear names. You stand frozen as homes are looted, women are assaulted, men are beaten and shot where they fall. These were known as the pogroms, and they swept the region. More than 1,000 of these in just a few years. And as the Jewish quarters were destroyed and violence moved on and tens of thousands are dead, the survivors flee with nothing, walking towards distant cities or foreign borders, hoping safety exists somewhere. You tell yourself there's nothing you could have done. You tell yourself you are protecting your own family. But at night, when the village is quiet, you remember those were your neighbors. And you are left with unbearable knowledge that the world is coming apart, and you watched and lived while others were erased. The church, too, during this time, was in crisis. And this is where I want to remind you. We're walking through much of the story together. In past episodes, we've traced the collapse of the old order, the revolution, the church's unraveling in the early Soviet years. And I'll link those episodes in the show notes. Because this moment only makes sense when we remember that the church also had just lost. Before 1917, the Russian Orthodox Church stood at the heart of public life. It was tightly bound to the state and supported by law, land, and privilege. But after the revolution, the world vanished almost overnight. In January 1918, a decree separating church and state ripped the church of its legal standing. It lost its property, and it lost its role in schools and civic life. Under the Bolshevik control, persecution followed quickly. The new regime viewed Christianity as an enemy of the revolution, an obstacle to creating the so-called New Soviet Man. Churches were shut or destroyed. Monasteries and convents, more than 500 by 1921, were dissolved. Sacred treasuries were confiscated. Religious institutions were banned. And in some regions, terror was blunt and public. Priests and nuns were tortured and executed. Processions were fired upon. Parishioners shot while defending their church. By the early Soviet period, tens of thousands of clergy had been arrested, imprisoned, and killed, with the first great wave beginning during these civil war years. Yet Russia was not ruled by a single power. There were areas controlled by the White Armies, Ukrainian nationalists, and local warlords. Churches were not necessarily protected and often targeted as threats. And all of this unfolded while at the same time, pogroms against the Jewish people raged through the Ukrainian towns and villages. The clergy's response was varied. Some were passive, some shared in their neighbors' anti-Semitism and blamed the Jews for all their problems, and some resisted, like the Archdeacon Clement Kaszurowski, who tried to protect the Jews and paid for his life. As we look at how the church responded during the attack on the Jewish people from the years of 1918 to 1921, we have to remember that the churches were facing their own devastation, that they had been stripped of privilege, persecuted under the Soviet rule. We also have to ask ourselves, did that give the church a reason, as some participated in, tolerated, or simply stood quietly by while the violence consumed their neighbors? Beyond the villages, Christian aid took on other forms. There was international relief missions. Many of them were Western, and a lot of them were brought by the church. These worked alongside Jewish organizations like the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee. They brought food, medical care, and basic supplies to the shattered Jewish communities in Ukraine from 1919 and onward. During that time, many Christians from these groups pleaded with local authorities and attempted, although unsuccessfully, to restrain the violence and to secure protection. There is one place where the silence breaks and where a name survives. History tells us of one man, one Christian man, who stood up. On February 15th, 1919, the killing began suddenly and moved fast. Troops surged through the streets, and within a matter of hours, nearly 1,000 Jewish men, women, and children were slaughtered. Panic drove survivors toward the cathedral courtyard, the last place that felt sacred, and the last place that might still offer protection. And inside that city was a man named Clement Kowalski. He could not remain indifferent, and when the violence erupted, he gathered Jewish children and hid them in the basement of his own home. Then he moved towards the church, where terrified families had gathered, believing that the walls of that holy place might restrain the bloodshed happening outside. There was shouting in the streets, crack of gunfire, and the sound of boots pounding against frozen ground. But the archdeacon, Clement Kowalski, does not stop to debate what this might cost him. He moves quickly through narrow lanes to his home, pulling children towards him as he goes. Small hands were clutching his robe. Some were crying, some were silent with shock. He ushered them down into his basement, into the damp, low, sealed space beneath his house, and pressed them into the shadows. He tells them to not make a sound, closes the door gently. Then he turns towards the church. The cathedral courtyard is full. Families are huddled together, praying, eyes fixed on the doors. The bells are silent, and smoke is drifting from rooftops. Screams are echoing through the streets. But these families wait, hoping that this might be a place where God will not allow the blood to be spilled. When the soldiers arrive, their rage is imminent. They rush the church gates, weapons raised, shouting orders that cut through the prayers. The Archduke, Clement Kowalski, steps forward alone. He put himself in the doorway, arms outreached. His body was the last barrier between the mob and those inside. And he pleads with them. He appeals to their conscience, to their faith, to the sanctity of this place they are about to defile. He warns them to stop, and he refuses to step aside. The blows come quickly. He's struck, knocked to the ground, and trampled under their boots. Bayonets are flashing. Blood begins to spread across the church courtyard stones. But then something shifted. The shouting faltered. The men hesitated. Whether it was out of shock or confusion, or the sudden weight of what they had just done, the momentum breaks. The crowd dispersed. And inside the church, families remained alive. However, Archduke Clement Kowalski does not rise again. But in those final moments, as his life drained away in the shadow of the church walls, although he could no longer stand, his stand still held. One man refused, and that man's refusal became a thin line between death and survival. Years later, in 1925, a memorial was erected at the mass grave, and among the relief panels are an image of rescue and names of those who risked their lives to save the Jews. And there is one panel called the Feet of a Priest in memory of Clement Kowalski. All of this happened in a town that was divided almost evenly between Jewish and Christian families. And yet, most of the Christian families, remained silent, locked in their own homes, while the violence erupted in the streets. This story is important because it shows us what resistance looks like. It doesn't have to be organized. It doesn't have to be loud. It doesn't even have to be victorious. It's often costly and brief. But one man stood in a doorway, one life given so others could live, in a time when most records speak of participation or silence. His story endures as proof that another path was possible, but that path demanded everything. The pogroms of the years following World War I were not an isolated eruption of violence. They were a warning. Before the Holocaust, before the term genocide was invented, before industrialized killing and death camps reshaped the world, the patterns were already visible in the streets of Europe. Jews were identified as outsiders, blamed for national collapse, and accused of belonging to every enemy all at once. The Russian Civil War exposed how deeply anti-Semitism was woven into society, how quickly neighbors could be mobilized against neighbors when fear and ideology replaced moral restraint. What unfolded between 1918 and 1921 became a grim rehearsal for the catastrophe that would follow in World War II. mass killings justified as necessity, silence from those who survived, and a world that struggled to respond. The violence in Russia reminds us that genocide doesn't begin at a gas chamber. It begins with scapegoating, with tolerated violence, and the belief that some lives are simply expendable. In our next episode, we're going to continue looking at church history during the time period between World War I and World War II. We're going to travel back to America, and we're going to look at the Roaring Twenties. In the meantime, remember that for the church, this period forces an uncomfortable reckoning. It reminds us that faith tied too closely to power can falter when the power collapses, and that silence in the face of injustice is never neutral. During this time period, many Christians were afraid, confused, or themselves under threat, and yet fear does not excuse indifference. What we learn from this time is that moral clarity matters most when it costs the most. The rare stories of rescue show that obedience to Christ is possible even in chaos. But these stories also show how exceptional such courage is. The church is not only called to preserve its buildings or protect its own survival, it's called to bear witness, to defend the vulnerable, to resist scapegoating, and to speak truth when lies are convenient. History teaches us that sometimes the church forgot its calling. A reminder for us today is to stand up. Don't forget your calling. Be the person God created you to be.
If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast app so you don't miss an episode. We release new content every Monday. And don't forget to check out our website at lauraleesiemens.com for more information and additional resources. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week as we continue our journey through the incredible history of the church.